Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 15, delivered on March 27, 2017. The title of this lecture is Investment Decision Making.
Today, investment decision making. Now, this is a topic that is at its heart actually fairly simple. However, you can write problems off this that will knock you dead. As a matter of fact, when I first started using this My Finance Lab, I was using some of their canned problems, and I ran into a couple that were just like, I mean, there was this one with this topic that was so complicated, by the end, I couldn't even find my own butt using both hands and a Rand McNally road atlas. I was just totally confused by it. And I thought, there's no reason to make it this complicated. It's actually very simple, not very simple, but it's just a relatively straightforward subject. So, but that aside, let me begin by again, exposing you to stock markets and screens and all that kind of stuff so that you can, idiots, deepen your comfort zone with this kind of stuff. With reading these screens. Now, starting out, we're going to look at the market summaries, the performance of the indices, and see what we can tell from there. Starting out with some basics. Sir, big up, big down, not big, not down, not big. It's a meh day, M-E-H, meh. Okay? And nothing. Yeah, there's a little bit of down trend on two of the indices, a little bit of up, but there's nothing spectacular. The market is in a wait and see, a holding pattern as it was last week. You see that quiet market. And from there, we can say, all right, let's look at some individual stocks and see what they tell us. To begin this journey today, we'll go with one, Kroger. Kroger. Now, Kroger is a consumer company, so kind of a little bit of a tick down, about an eighth of a percent, about a half percent down. So before we go any further, we're going to make you into investment analysts. Ma'am, now, you know, you might recall that if I slide down a little bit, I'll see the volume on the stock today and the 52-week average volume. What do you suppose I'll see for the volume today versus the 52-week average volume?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Madam, what would you say? A little lower today?
A little lower today.
Well, let's find out. We have a call that it'll be lower today because the markets are quiet. So let's see. Well, I'll be darned. She's right. Give her a cigar, a Cuban. We can get those now. Legally. Okay, so the thing is that you're absolutely right. See, you're becoming aware. You're beginning to think about in the way we do. We think ahead of the information because the information is going to probably be consistent with what we think. If it's not, Then we begin to worry. When things go sideways, that's where the real interest is. Now, there will be earnings reports coming out for a lot of these companies in the next few days, next few weeks. And the market has already absorbed into all of the prices, volume, all that, what it thinks will happen. The expectation has already been put in there. Now, if it isn't what we expect, that's when we get all kinds of excited. But if what we think that Kroger is going to have earnings that are expected, it's not going to be spectacular, well, it's already there. It's already there. So if Kroger comes in, its earnings were up just like we thought, well, that's not, the stock price isn't going to do anything with that information because that information was already expected, it was already there. You are a newbie in the business, but even you could see that the volume was probably not going to be big today because the market's quiet. Now, tell me, it's we got a beta on Kroger of 0.29 and a P.E. ratio of 14.11. What are those telling you? It's a very safe stock. This is a grandma stock. This is something that you would put in a portfolio of a couple in their 50s or later 40s maybe. And we see that they're both confirming about the same thing, and it's got a nice little dividend. So if I spend about $2,893 plus commissions, every year I will get a check for $48. Now, it'll be divided. I think it'll be quarterly payments or something like that. But, I mean, it's not going to be a spectacular. Kroger's not going to be roaring upward. But also, this is a company that I see as a survivor, which is in itself something that you applaud for a grocery store chain like Kroger, which didn't go the superstore route. It's been pretty much going head-to-head with Walmart, Hy-Vee, Giant Eagle, Meijer, without going to the massive storefronts, although it is going that way now, but it's going that way in a very quiet sort of fashion. Okay, so, and I can see now, is this stock near its 52-week high or it's near its 52-week low? That's the next thing that we want to look at. And I'm just getting you to the point where you're used to doing this as part of your work. Ma'am, what would you say? Is it near the high or near the low or in the middle? It's near the low. It's testing the neckline. We saw that last time with stocks. More than what just one stock is testing a neckline on the downside, which is something that we ought to think about, is that these stocks are probing down there, but none of the big players are really interested in pushing it too far quite yet. Now, two new terms, bulls and bears. Bulls are optimistic. They're big, they believe that the stock market's going to go up. Bears are investors that believe the stock market is going to go down. Sometimes the bulls win, sometimes the bears win. Now I'm going to bring up two more terms, one of which you'll be comfortable with, one of which you'll have to think about for a while to really absorb it. But right now, the bulls and bears are standing on a line on a neckline. And we're going to see over the next couple of months who's going to win that fight. The bulls would say this is a buying opportunity. The stocks are near their 52-week low, so let's buy in now because these are bargains. The bears are saying, no, this is the beginning of the end. The stock markets are going to fall because what we're seeing is the beginning of a recessionary environment. And recessions tend to hit consumer companies before they hit, well, they pretty hard, especially grocery stores can suffer in recessions, although Kroger has proven itself to be a decent stock. Not that I'm endorsing any stocks here, but that one's okay. Now, getting away from that, we can look at a company, another one. Let's look at a war stock. Halliburton. Down 3.33%. Strong volume, bucking the trend. There's a lot more uncertainty in the war stocks right now. Up and down, they're more volatile these days just because there are a lot more prospects for us to be left on the sidelines as an isolationist country, so our war stocks wouldn't make much money. But also there's the potential for us to get dragged into something really, really ugly over the next year and a half in the Baltics if we don't maintain our isolationist behavior we're doing right now. Notice that we have a negative earnings per share, and as I had told you before, many companies and certainly most analysts really just don't care about accounting information anymore. That net income is not what we care about. You're going to hear me in the lecture's main body today using the term free cash flow. You won't hear me say profit. You won't hear me say net income. I'll just keep emphasizing, we care about money. Money in, money out. Not what is required under generally accepted accounting principles consistently applied. You're going to hear me taking a harder line as you go further in because you're getting closer to becoming business professionals. So we've got to shake out what we have to do that they make us do, and as opposed to what we need to do to keep ourselves in business. Heavy volume. Now, let's go for something like Kellogg. High volume today, striking down. Bulls and bears are fighting at the 52-week. See how it's near its 52-week low? Again, that's something that is of concern. It means that there's a buying opportunity if you're a bull. This is your sell signal if you're a bear. If it crosses that neckline, it's at 70 3/4. That's when you're going to see the bears run the bulls right out of the stadium. Promise you, if it crosses that neckline, the bears are going to be throwing things around. Have you ever had a bear come into your store? You notice when a bear, I'll tell you this, when a bear comes into your store, everyone leaves. The bear goes in, everyone goes out, okay? So we say the bears are going to run out the bulls in this. Now for another term. Two terms. Long. That means that you own the stock. I am long 100 shares of Kellogg. Means that I have bought 100 shares of Kellogg. I am betting that the stock is going to go up, or at least that the stock is a good thing to have in a portfolio. The other term is short. I am short this stock. It is the one that most people don't even think about. The screens don't talk about it. And yet it is a huge part of any market. Here's how short would works. Okay, if I'm short, what I would do is I would short Kellogg. I would borrow 100 shares of Kellogg stock. Okay? And then what I would do is I would sell those shares. Or rather, I'm sorry, I would sell those shares. And then what I would do is I would buy them back when the stock fell to, let's say, 65. And then I would give the stock back to where I borrowed it from. And you're not borrowing it from a person. That's just a market has the stock there. So I would borrow the stock at its current price. And then when I needed to, I would sell it at that price. And then when the stock fell, I would buy it back at the lower price and give it back to the place where I borrowed it from. That's a short. And if it doesn't make sense, if it doesn't quite hit, trust me, you have to just sort of think about it. But it is just as much an important part of the market as going long. Long is what everyone who's not a professional thinks. But you can short just as easily as you can go long. And if you think that the market's going to go down, you don't say, oh, God, what do I do? You short. You short the hell out of what you think is going to go down. And that's just as much. If you think the stock's going to go up, you buy the stock. If you think the market's a stock is going to go down, you short the stock. It's every bit as much of a part of the market, and yet everyone talks as if the only thing you can do is buy stock and then sell it when you make when the price goes up. No, you can sell stock and then buy it back when the price goes down and make a buck off the drop. So bears would short and bulls would go long. Now, interestingly enough, usually you would say, I am going to short the stock. But if on the other side, you would say, I will go long the stock. So there's a slight difference in this construction of the sentence that you would use, the verb setup that you would use. I would short the stock, I'd go long the stock. I am short the stock, I am long the stock. So in other words, well, what are you doing with Kroger? Well, I am short the stock right now. I'm shorting it. I'm short. Or I'm long Kroger. You would say it that way. You get into the habit of talking like this, and the way you speak shapes the way you think. And the more you speak the way we do, the more you think the way we do, whether you like it or not. But so you want to keep that in mind. And that's another thing, too, is we look at all of the buys on stock, but it's worth it to also find a place that will give you the open short interest on stocks, too. Because you can have a stock going up. The bulls are roaming the field. But you could also see a lot of open short interest, which means the bears are just gathering up their honey, and they're waiting for those bulls to be too stupid to look around them, and the bulls are going to fall off the cliff. And so, in other words, just because the stock is going up doesn't mean everything is fine and dandy hunky-dory. Look at the short interest open on a stock to see what the bears think about it, and especially how much short interest is open. Look, there are going to be bears all the time. There are going to be bulls all the time. So what you want to do is say, all right, on what's a typical short open position? What's the typical short open? And then you see what the days is or the week's open interest is, short open interest is, and you say, all right, that's a little high. Wonder what the bears are worried about or what the bears are getting excited about. Because bears like it when the stock market goes down. Bulls like it when the stock market goes up. So if you've got an open short interest, that means the bears see something they like, which means they see apocalypse happening, a minor apocalypse. You know, not full-blown zombies, maybe midget zombies, which is really scary in and of itself. Like, geez, that actually is creepy. Okay, anyway, so there's a couple of issues right there. Now, notice something here, right off the bat. It's kind of an important one. So crazy about getting everything said, I almost sometimes forget to bring up things. Ma'am, I want you to look. What does the beta tell you about the stock? Okay. It's okay. What does the beta tell you?
That it's a safe stock.
Yeah, it's safe. Below one. And the farther below one towards zero, the safer it is. Now, sir, look at the P-E ratio. Is that telling you the same thing?
No.
Good. Very good. The P-E ratio is a little on the high side. It's a little rich, okay? So, now, do you remember what I said? If you have one thing that's saying safe and one thing that's saying dangerous, which do you go with?
The one that's dangerous.
Yes. This is called the mini-max principle. Minimize your maximum loss. Form your strategies based upon making the best of the worst-case scenario. So if I see good news and I see bad news all in one person, I am going to give the bad news more weight than I am the good news. Because the good news, all it can do is buy me dinner. The bad news could take me and send me to hell for all eternity, burn my house to the ground, and make me wear shoes that didn't fit. That's right, we're talking bad. And you would have to listen to dubstep for the rest of your eternity. And Nickelback. Okay, so yeah, in this case, I mean, Kellogg is, I see that same influence of a market that is beginning to get a little bit edgy on consumer stuff. I saw it with Kroger. I'm seeing it with Kellogg. And when I think about Kellogg, why would Kellogg be going down? I mean, grain prices are stupidly low anymore. Farmers are getting creamed these days. I don't see any bizarrely large demand. We're doing better every year trying to feed the world's population. We don't have nearly as many people starving as we used to. I mean, it's not like there's some surge of demand that can't be fulfilled. I mean, prices of grain are looking good. So the only thing that would be telling me is that there's a general, the word that we use is, the French word is ennui, this kind of morose feeling that there's something not so great going to happen. And Kellogg is known for its consumer products, for its cereals and things like that. Might be during a recession, people still buy those kinds of basic staples, but they go from buying the fancy name brand cereals, maybe to buy more generics. They tend to go from buying Charmin toilet paper down to sandpaper specials and all that kind of stuff. That's the only thing I can see that could be possibly swinging. That Kellogg, the market is just not very happy right now. The volume is a little higher. As a matter of fact, that's a pretty strong volume on Kellogg on the downside. And the news, there might have been some major news today about it, but mostly that just doesn't look like the market is in a very good mood right now. The market is moody. It's pissy. And so you just have to kind of stay, you know, ride with it for a while. Have you ever had a very good friend? Most days that friend is very happy, but there are those days when that friend is just bitchy and pissy and everything's wrong. Does that mean that you, you know, me, I just throw them out of the car at 50 miles an hour, there. But, you know, most people don't. You live with them, you get through the bad times, you wait for the good times, and if those don't happen, then you throw them out of the car when you're going over a bridge that's very tall. And down below are shark-infested waters and rocks and maybe toxic waste from a nuclear power plant. Yeah. But right away, you don't do that, okay? So the market is pissy right now. That doesn't mean we're going to throw everything out. And if you're going to turn into a bear, well, you got to think hard before you decide you're going to start being a bear. You end up being like me. You have a crooked nose. You drink very, very bad coffee. And your cat's shed. Okay. Now I'm going to take you on another journey. Take you past that. Now, I can do these calculations on several different calculators, but do I have any marketing majors in here who would admit it? Yeah, okay. You're a marketing major. Now, you're going to come up with incredible ideas. You'll be in charge of product designs and genius advertising campaigns. And before you can do those, you'll need money. And this money, we're going to spend it, and then all of this money will come in over the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Free cash flow will be negative at first, and then it will be positive. And then you walk into the finance department because they're going to say yes or no. And you know who is the chief financial officer? Grumpy Cat and me. And we're going to say no. And you're going to say, no, wait, why? No. It's going to be an up or a down. It's not going to be a nuance. It's not going to be a negotiation. You're going to give me a project with the free cash flow profile. And I'm going to say yes or no. And that's all there's going to be to it. Now, in this lecture and in the next one, you see how we come to that. It's not nuanced. If the number is positive, we say yes. If the number is negative, we say no with one of the methods. And if the number is above a certain value, we say yes. And if it's below a certain value, we say no with another of the methods. But in either case, It is not a matter of, well, some Zen thing where we look at all the different angles of it. We call mom, see what she thinks, and, you know, maybe we go out and we get ourselves wasted, and then we decide, no. It's yes or no. The nuance of it is just not there with us. So, without further ado on this, where's my, Now, I start with simple projects. There's one cash flow out at the beginning, and then that creates, that generates an annuity, probably an unlevel annuity, although we use these problems where it's level, it makes it easier for the calculator. But I'm going to show you how you don't have to kill yourself on that part if you don't want to. But here's the deal. Suppose that this project is going to cost initially $5,000 at year zero. That's the free cash flow. Now, again, I am not writing revenue. I'm not writing net income. I'm talking about physical money. It's going to cost $5,000 right up front. And then this project is going to have a life of 4 years where it will be producing money. The first year, it will pick up some customers, and it'll have $1,000 of free cash flow come in. The second year, $2,000. The third year, $1,500. And the fourth year, $750. The project will then end with a salvage value of $600. Now, here's where I have to tell you something. Salvage value. Sometimes you'll see a salvage value, sometimes you won't. In the real world, when you're doing these, too many times they'll say there's no salvage value, and yet they are wrong. And I'm going to have to tell you something really right now that's you can't tell anyone that I'm telling you this, okay? Seriously. Sir, below here, you know, the atrium where they have the overpriced stuff in the cafe and they have the way overpriced snack machine, you know, and all that, but there's a secret room. It's huge. You guys have never seen it, and you're not allowed to go in there. Did you know that? Did you know there's a secret room? Huh? It's actually more than half the basement. You know what's in there? Dead things. I know, right? I mean, students, yeah. I mean, but much more importantly, dead technologies. In there are computers that have keyboards in Sanskrit. They have monitors that are clay tablets. They have computers with that used to take the floppy disk. You've never seen, I'll bet not one of you has ever seen a floppy disk that was 8 inches. Yeah, you think about the 4 and a 5 and a quarter. These are ka-chung. And those things, man, they held 64K of data. Seriously, noob. Yeah, I mean, it was mind-blowing in my time. Yeah, we had these guys we beat up. They started talking about 128K and all that. You know, the modem. Yeah, right, we're ever going to have a modem that goes to 64K kilobytes per second. But anyway, you see, all those monitors, those computers, they just took them down there instead of selling them. Back at the time, they were technologically a little out of date, but you could have still sold them. You could donate them for tax purposes to schools that would have killed to have computers like that at that time. You see, all these companies, so many companies, they just throw it away or put it in a warehouse or bury it instead of getting rid of it when it still has value. Well, what's the salvage value? Oh, there was none. We didn't sell it. Well, no, that doesn't matter whether you sold it or not. All that matters is whether you're stupid or not. There was an opportunity cost to you not doing it. What was it worth? That is salvage value. Not what you got for it, but what it was worth. You, madam, might get $40,000 a year. You might be worth $90,000. So when I say, what are you worth? You better decide you're worth $90,000. That's why you would only, if you don't, that's why you would get only $40,000. Okay? And so when you think about salvage value, don't take zero for an answer in a company. What could we do with that? Can we sell it to a factoring company, to odd lots? Can we sell it? Can we give it away and get some tax deductions for it? Okay, I've bitched about that enough. And I think the problems that I've set up for you in the homework and quiz and test online, most of those do have very little salvage value. But what you do, if you see a salvage value, just put it on the last year's cash flow. It becomes part of it. And you put it there because if the project is over, get rid of the technology. Sell the factory. Sell the equipment. Sell the employees if they you can find a good market for them. Whatever. Sell the excess inventory. Clean the factory out, okay? I can't emphasize things like that enough. If you ever took a management course from me, you'd hear a lot more of my bitching like that. Okay. Now, let's get down to it. Let's say that we are going... Now, we are going to calculate the first decision criterion is called net present value, NPV. We are going to bring back to the present all of these free cash flows. To do that, I'm going to need a, what in the, that's supposed to be off. We're going to need a discount rate. That's my cat getting in front of the security camera. Wait, sorry, I got to. Get out of there. Of course, thinking that could have been that old landlady, and I'm going to find her corpse there when I get back. Hate that woman. Anyway, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take the discount rate at 8%. Now, where am I getting 8%? For now, I'm getting it out of thin air. Later, I'll show you that how we actually can calculate the discount rate that would be appropriate for the risk level of these cash flows. But for now, I'm just going to take the 1,000, discount it back one period, the 2,000, discount it back two periods at the 1.08. I'm going to take the 1,500, discount it back three periods at the 1.08. And then take the 1,350 and discount it back at 1,350 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative fourth. Add those up and find out what my answer is. Now, this is where it gets to be a pain in the butt. But we can make it a lot easier, but I wanted to have, do one straight up with a quick scientific calculator attack on it. I'm going to just say, okay, 1,000, whoops, well, let's try it again. 1,000 times 1.08 to the negative 1, open parentheses, negative 1, close parentheses, I see. Plus 2,000 times 1.08 y to the x 2 posneg, close the parentheses, plus 1500 times 1.08 to the 3, pause neg, close the parentheses on that exponent, plus 1350 times 1.08 y to the x, 4, pause neg, close the parentheses, equals 482364. Now, the net present value. Now, when you write this, don't capitalize it. It's not capitalized. The abbreviation is capital N, capital P, capital V, but don't do that. If you're communicating with someone in a business environment, don't just say NPV. State net present value, because you're probably going to have someone who doesn't have as much training as you do and definitely didn't have as good a professor as you did. So just write it, just plain old net present value is going to be negative $5,000 plus $4,823.64, which comes out to be 36.176 negative. We reject the project. It's negative. It's negative, you say no. Well, what if it was only $3 negative? No. $2? No. 3 cents? No. If it's negative, no. If it's positive, yes. Don't make your life complicated. And don't let someone come to you, well, I've modified the numbers. No, you brought me the numbers. And if you cared about the project, you would have brought me the right number the first time, which I assume you did. So don't modify it. You got a negative number. That's the end of the project right there. Gone. The 8% is crucial to this, however. Like I said, for now, I'm pulling it out of my backside, but I will get it, show you how to do it later. However, I want to show you a simpler approach, how you can use a calculator to do this. A financial calculator, I'm going to use the Pearson calculator because it's actually pretty darn nice for this. Pulling up the Pearson financial calculator, the first thing you do is you hit reset. Now watch me do this so that you don't struggle with these with a formula or something like that. Now I'm going to say cash flow, CF. I'm going to hit the CF button. You have to do that first. Put that at the top of your notes. Hit CF. Now watch. It's really not that hard. See how it's already prompting me for the initial cash flow, which will be the negative amount, 5,000 pos neg. Don't forget the pos neg button afterwards. Okay? Now, hit the drop down key. Okay? Down. And now it's going to say, all right, what's the first positive cash flow? And I'm going to say, here it is, $1,000. Drop it down. It's going to say, how many years does that happen? One. Frequency. That's very cool. If you have a cash flow like the same amount of money for 5 years, 10 years, oh, that's a great thing. The downside is that it desynchronizes the numbers on the left side from the years. But we don't have to worry about that here. That's one. Now go to CO, cash flow two was 2,000. Use the down arrow, and it's going to say, how many times did that one happen? Just once. I always, for some reason, I hit the equal sign after that. I don't think you have to. It's cash flow three. What's that one? That one is 1,500. Hit the down arrow. How many times did that happen? Just once. So we go to cash flow four, down arrow, and we key in the 1350. Hit the down arrow, and your frequency was once on that one. Now we're going to go to I over Y. I'm going to hit the I over Y button and say 8%. I over Y, hit it again. I don't know how why that does that, but... Okay, now, compute NPV. I'll be darned. Look at that. Isn't that a lot easier? You get the hang of that. So, we have found now that this project is a no-go at 8%. Now, I'm going to draw a graph here. On the vertical axis, I'm going to draw net present value. On the vertical axis, net present value. Now, on the horizontal axis, I'm going to draw the discount rate. And on the vertical axis, we'll go 100, 2, 3, whoops, that's not enough of a scale. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then negative 100, 2, 3, 4, 5. And on the here, 1%, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so now I've done that, okay? I found that at a discount rate of 8%, my net present value was negative $176, right about there, okay? Okay, what if I had used 6% instead of 8%? Now, I hope you can see that that would be a pain in the butt if I had to do it with the scientific calculator approach. But watch this. With this little bad calculator, or any one that says good, just key in 6% I over Y and compute net present value again. Well, spank me. $52.14 positive. So in other words, 8% gave me an NPV of negative $176 and change. 6% gave me a slightly positive number, $52 and some odd cents, 14. It's right about there. Oh, I wonder what $4% would do. Let's try 4%. Compute the NP. Net present value. $298. $0.13. Almost $300. Let's try 10%. See if there's a consistency in this. We'll put in 10%. I over Y, compute the net present value. Negative $388.98. Negative $398.88. So in other words, that would be 10%. Right about there. Yep. What I'm doing here then is I am graphing for you what we call the net present value profile of this project. The net present value profile of this project. Every project will have its own NPV profile. Some of them the line will be very steep, some of them will be shallower. But you see, what we're doing here is we're seeing that at low discount rates, projects are accepted. See how the NPV is positive? At high discount rates, projects are rejected. This place, this crossing point right here, has a name. It's called the internal rate of return. Now, again, you don't capitalize internal rate of return unless you're just writing IRR. But don't do that if you're communicating with someone who doesn't necessarily know what you're talking about here with saying IRR. Now, the internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project equal zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project equal zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate. Now, notice how many times I'm repeating this. You think you should make sure that you know this one for a test, or hint, hint, nudge, nudge. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project equal zero. Now, if I say it that many times, this is something you might want to get tattooed on one of your tats. You're going to have, like, I'm thinking about 5 or 6 tats coming out of this class. Yeah. Okay. So, but you understand here that this is a decision criterion. Now, the internal rate of return is one of the decision criteria. I'm sorry, the net present value is one of the decision criteria you could use. However, the internal rate of return is used by itself by companies. Here's the thing. Suppose that you, madam, are the financial analyst, the newbie at Financial Analysts Are Us. Okay? And you saw the cash flow, free cash flow profile for a project. You didn't have any discount rate, but you can still always, oh, by the way, let me show you something real quick here. It looks like about 6.5%, right, for the internal rate of return for this project. Watch this. Once you've keyed in the cash flow profile, compute internal rate of return, oh, spank me, 6.44%, that easy. You don't even have to guess. There it is, 6.44%. Okay, now, madam, back to our things. You went and you used your calculator, and you'd seen the cash flow profile, and you figured out that there was a project that had an internal rate of return of 9.6%. And I'm the chief financial officer, and I've come to you now the next day. You will use a discount rate of 8%. Now, I expect you to tell me whether to go with this project or not by the end of the day. You can answer me right there. What's yes or no? Yes. Yes. Because, you see, the internal rate of return is where the project crosses from positive NPV to negative NPV. I just told you that you found the internal rate of return was 9.6%, and then I said, I want you to look at 8% and see if it works. Of course it does, because it'd be positive at that point. You see it? Yes. So we're going to just send you back to stormtroopers. Yeah. Until you stop missing everything. Stormtroopers, they can't shoot. I mean, seriously, there's Harrison Ford, there's Leia. How hard is it to kill them? Apparently very hard, because they were well paid for the movies. Okay, so the point here is that the internal rate of return can be used this way. However, it's used a backwards way by a lot of companies. Here's what they do. They don't even look at NPVs. See, IRR can be used on it. What they do is they set, whoops, and this is exactly the backwards of it, of what you should do with it. They set a hurdle rate. They say, this is, all projects must beat our hurdle rate. So let's say that they set the hurdle rate at 10%. So all the projects, they just do their IRRs. And if the internal rate of return is below 10%, they say no. If it's above 10%, they say yes. Think about it this way. Project A, Project B. Project A, the internal rate of return of Project A is 8.8%. The internal rate of return of Project B is 12.6%. Project A will be rejected because its NPV profile is negative by the time it gets to the hurdle rate. Make sure you see that. Project B says yes. They say yes to Project B because at the hurdle rate, it's still a positive net present value project. This is a very big thing. This is a very big method in companies. And the problem with it is, where do you get the hurdle rate? My experience with companies that I've consulted for over the years and with the CFOs that use hurdle rates, they don't know. They just sort of, in one case, this was back in, I remember distinctly, in 1997, I was at a dinner with the finance people of a company I was consulting for, and I said, they had brought up, somewhere that day, the hurdle rate had come up. It was something like 12%. And I said, well, where did that hurdle rate come from? The CFO himself got quiet, and he said, I'm not really sure. We've just always used that hurdle rate. Wait. You mean when interest rates in the economy go up, interest rates in the economy go down, you're still using the same hurdle rate no matter what? Well, yeah. Why? Why? What's the problem? Are you on crack? The hurdle rate should be moving. I mean, even at that, where are you getting that? Is God telling you that? Your mom? Did you call your mom? No, you didn't call your mom. I was there with her, and she didn't answer the phone. Oh, I'm so glad to delete that. Anyway, where the hell was I? Okay, look. It's just sort of pulled out of the air, out of thin air. And that's the problem with hurdle rates, is they don't have any justification other than that's what we've always done before and that's what we're going to do now. Yeah, well, that's fine for the Amish, but we're not Amish. I come... My family comes from Kentucky, okay? They would have this thing. If they saw anything that was new, they'd say, it might be right for some, but it ain't for us Kentucky people. Hey, yeah, you know, like false teeth and things like that. You know, really? Okay. But there's another problem with the internal rate of return. But I'll get to that in a minute. There's an old, old way of project. And when I was a consultant... Okay, when I started doing business classes years and years ago, they showed us this ridiculous method. And I thought, no one's ever going to be, no one in the modern world, you know, modern world, 1980s, would ever use anything like this. But when I started doing consulting, I found out a lot of companies were still using this really old method from a long, long time ago. It's called the payback method. The payback method, it's pretty much just you set a number of years a project has to pay for itself. Okay, so let's say that the payback period for this company's projects is 4 years. All projects must pay themselves off within 4 years. So you've got a project that costs $10,000 up front. Year zero. One, two, three, four, five, 1,000 in the first year comes in, 2,000 comes in the second year, 4,000 comes in the third year, in the third year, 4,000 comes in, and then 5,000 in the fourth year, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 1,000, and then the project dies at 200 in the sixth year. This one would clear the payback hurdle, because in year one, 1,000, year two, a total of 3,000, year four, a total of 7,000, I'm sorry, year three, a total of 7,000, year four, a total of 12,000, so it would be accepted. But do you see why that's a big, bad, stupid thing to do? Because $4,000 out, $5,000, 4 years out, ain't worth $5,000 now. You're comparing this money out here like it's the same as this money that you're paying out up front. Instead of doing discounts on them, taking the discounted cash flows, you're just taking them as if this $5,000 here is equivalent to the $10,000 that you paid out up front. Bad idea. I found out that it was still being used in a lot of companies in the 80s and 90s when I was doing consulting. There was the other problem. I said, well, where do you get that payback period from? Well, that's just the way we've always done it. My dad founded the business, and he said a payback period should be 5 years, so that's what we do. Your dad's dead. Yeah, but he can still beat me. Okay, cool. But where the hell was it? Oh, okay, so. And then there's another problem, too. But actually, the problem that I'm going to bring up here in a minute is a little bit larger. One thing I should tell you right now is the internal rate of return is a little, at least a few years ago, it was still more popular than NPV, even though it has a major, major flaw in it. In 2013, slightly more companies were using an internal rate of return type of criterion, usually a hurdle rate type of deal with it. As far as I know, there was a survey done at the end of last year that said that more companies are now using NPV, which is a good thing because internal rate of return has a problem. You see, if you have just one cash flow change from negative to positive, the NPV profile looks like this. You have an internal rate of return. The problem comes if your cash flow switches sign more than once. NPV still works. You just do your net present value. But internal rate of return, the actual graph of the function, turns weird. There are two internal rates of return. Neither of them means anything. But your calculator is going to give you one of them, and it's not going to know that there's something wrong. What it will do is it will find the internal rate of return closest to where it starts looking. Calculators use this back and forth at extremely high speed. The calculator is going to give you an internal rate of return and say, here it is, but that internal rate of return doesn't mean anything. Neither of them does. They're what we call in mathematics spurious results. So you got to watch out for that. Now, I'm going to show you in the next lecture a trick you can do with internal rate of return to make it so that it cleans that mess up, but it's still a trick. One last thing to bring up here. All of what we're doing here would be good for companies in some kind of competition, either something like close to perfect competition, but more likely monopolistic competition. The problem with this whole thing is that it doesn't work if you're talking about projects that have to take a very, very long time. This is the world of oligopolies. Companies that don't price and plan tactically, they price and plan strategically. Think about this. In your lifetimes, we're going to mine asteroids. That's a no-brainer. We're going to put tourism and colonies in space and probably on Mars. We're going to finally, it'll take about 30 more years, we're going to get teleportation down. We're going to get instantaneous communication through quantum entanglement. We're going to start throwing Sirius probes out to the nearby star systems to see if there's any place we can live once we've wrecked this hellhole we've made of Earth. This is all going to happen in your lifetime. The problem is it's going to cost like hell for years. The payoffs are going to come 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now. So that means that present values of the positive cash flows are going to be virtually zero. And yet we have to do it. And that's the problem with all the methods I'm showing you is this isn't going to, we can't do the evaluation with our typical methods. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.